And we're... Our next speaker is Jeff Arnold. He's going to talk a little bit about the modeling activity that he's undertaken and the ecosystem support services that are involved in there. Thanks, Jeff.
All right. Thank you, Alan. I really appreciate this opportunity to come and talk about the models. I'm an ag engineer with USDA ARS in Temple. Jim Canary is a research agronomist, also with ARS, and Jimmy Williams, the father of a lot of the models, ARS, the USDA models, is, after a long career with ARS, is now with Texas AgriLife. We'll look at some of the different scales of the models that we're working on, also the processes. Look at just briefly model input and output. And then look at some examples. Some examples that Jim has done with bioenergy, corn for ethanol, and then finish up with a very large scale application of SEEP to the upper Mississippi. Okay, these are all models that have been developed in Temple over the last maybe 20 years. They're supported at Temple, but we have collaborations with scientists around the country and around the world to continue to develop and support the models. Almanac model is a field scale model assuming homogeneous soils, climate, and so on, really focusing on plant growth. It started as a plant competition model, I believe, between grasses and crops. And recently, in the last several years, Jim has been working on trees, parameterizing and calibrating the model, different tree species, grasses. And keep in mind that Almanac is a canopy level model, a leaf area scale model. Apex is more of a farm to small watershed scale model. One of the real strengths is in landscape routing across the landscape, wind erosion, carbon dynamics. It has a century carbon model built into it. And it's evolved into a comprehensive agricultural watershed management model. SWAT is a river watershed to river basin scale model, and as far as scales go, most of the processes in all these models are on a daily time step. As far as scales, Almanac at the field, whatever size field you feel comfortable with being homogeneous. Apex, looking at routing across the landscape, whole farms up to maybe tens or even 100 square mile watersheds. And with SWAT, we're looking at the tens of hundreds of square miles up to major river basins, where we focus on some of the scaling, base flow, channel and reservoir routing, spatial climate variability. In the last few years, we've done a lot of work on urban processes and urban management practices. Apex, we can model deterministically the actual fields, the water balance, the management, and so on, and then route that across other fields that can be concentrated flow, runoff and run-on from one to another, whether that's a buffer, whether it's just across the landscape, through wetlands, and so on. In the SWAT watershed system, we're looking at all sources within a basin. We're going to have point sources probably, whether those are wastewater sites, different industries, so we have to include those. We read those into a file in SWAT, and then we take that and put it into the stream at the appropriate location and route that down through the watershed, through the impoundments and through the reservoirs. The urban areas and uncultivated areas, pastures, forests, urban areas. In the SEEP project, we actually simulate the cultivated lands with Apex, and at the subbasin, we aggregate those at the subbasin, determine a delivery ratio, delivery of those into the water bodies, and then read that into a file in SWAT and route that through channel and floodplain processes. Okay. I think the important things when we think about the multiple processes, the important things to remember is that, as in nature, they're all interconnected. If we change the hydrology at all, if we put in tiles, if we change the crop type, the plant type, we're going to change surface runoff. We can change tile flow, base flow, and whenever we do that, we change the transport, the sediment, how nitrogen is delivered through tiles, and so on. The other very important thing in the models is that you have a direct impact of land management, where we can schedule nutrient manure operations, tillages, and schedule cropping systems, and then also scale the sources and sinks of sediment and water as we route down through the watershed. And we'll talk about some of these things, the hydrology and erosion, plant growth. We do have carbon balances now. We have a pathogen model. Ali Sadeghi developed a pathogen model. It's in SWOT now. And we're looking at some emerging contaminants, antibiotics and hormones. Even though I don't think we have a real good understanding of the fate of some of those, we're trying to model those as best we can. Okay. As far as the hydrologic balance, we have two conceptual layers, the soil profile, usually a meter or two in depth, multiple layers, where all the ET, the impact of surface runoff, ET, leaching. It's important in the processes and when we run scenarios that we have that surface base flow ratio is realistic because that's a very important impact on transport of other pollutants. The shallow aquifer, basically what percolates through the soil roots, the soil profile is allowed to lag through that shallow aquifer. We do that very simply in SWOT. Some people have linked that to mod flow or more spatially distributed models. As far as the nitrogen cycle, keep in mind that this is done for every field, for every land use in a watershed. We keep up with this on a daily basis. Most of these processes are daily. So for each soil layer, we have soil pools, storages for ammonia, nitrate, several different organic pools, and we keep up with the mineralization, different nutrient cycling on a daily time step. So if we do have a runoff event or a leaching event, we have an estimate of how much is in the soil, so we can predict that. The other important things are the plant balance, the nitrogen uptake, and the removal and the yield of some of the nutrients. Pesticide dynamics, we use a GLEAMS type approach where we have a KD and a half-life. We have in the management file, we schedule applications, we put that into the proper soluble or sorb pools and allow that to be transported and degraded over time. Okay, in plant growth, again, we use a radiation use efficiency. We look at the photosynthetically active radiation with leaf area index and compute optimum growth, and then constraints. We have water constraint, aeration stress, limited water, temperature, nitrogen, phosphorus stresses. As far as yield prediction, we input an optimum harvest index. That's also subject to a water stress. Again, the plant growth is and management is critical on residue cover for erosion on the just the overall nitrogen and phosphorus balances. Okay. Typical climate change applications will take a global circular regionalized circulation model, estimates of precip, temperature, humidity, wind speed, and so on. Include that in the model. Look at the impact not only on plant growth, crop yields, but also on the hydrology and pollutant loadings. As far as CO2 goes, we adjust the radiation use efficiency for CO2, and also in the Penman-Monteith ET equation, we can adjust for CO2 impact on leaf conductance. Okay, once we have the runoff and all the pollutants loaded to the stream, then we go through a routing process and look at sources and sinks of nutrients and sediment as we move through the channels and floodplains. We have flood routing models. We look at the whole water balance, sediment routing in the channel and floodplain. We can degrade or deposit as we move through the different reaches down through the system. And we also have changes for nutrients and pesticides as we move through the channels. Okay. As far as required inputs to the model, obviously, the DEM, we need slope lengths, the soils, all the physical properties, bulk densities, water capacities, chemical properties, pH, initial organic, initial nutrients, initial carbon concentrations, weather, typically daily. As I said, most of the processes are on a daily basis. We do simulate some processes sub-daily, such as runoff and flood routing can go down to a matter of minutes. And again, the most important probably input is the land use and the management. As far as calibration and validation data, we collect as much stream flow, sediment, and phosphorus data as we can get a hold of. This would be a more typical watershed. You know, these are This may be a 50 to 100 square mile watershed. For each of these sub-basins are probably a few square miles. This would be a typical basin delineation for a TMDL or other local watersheds. And we'll look at a national conservation project in a few minutes at a much larger scale. Okay, we also have GIS interfaces that just basically help us pull that data together, because you're looking at a watershed with hundreds or thousands of sub-basins and at least as many land uses. It just gets to be tedious pulling all that data together, how they're routed together. So the GIS can delineate the sub-basins for us and pull all that routing structure, overlay the soil and land use, and automate a good bit of our model input. So it's over the last 10 or 15 years just become an invaluable tool for setting up the models. As far as some of the structural management that we address in the models, the contouring, terracing, buffer strips, filter strips, grass waterways, tile drainage, windbreaks for wind erosion, and some of the urban management. We've looked at a lot of impoundments for urban management, settling and other type impoundments. Now we're looking at things like green roofs and trying to incorporate pervious parking lots and streets and so on. In addition to some of the structural practices, again, each of the land uses, each of the response units in the model have a management file where you actually input dates and amounts of fertilizer application. The model puts those into the appropriate pool, so the impact of timing and application rates on fertilizer and manure, different cropping systems, grazing and manure applications. Jimmy has a very detailed grazing model in Apex where he can move cattle around and as they environmentally impact the fields. Okay, so the basic output of the models, in addition to the water balance, sediment sources and sinks as we route through the watershed, we do have a time series of output at each sub-basin outlet. We'll have a time series of output, whether it's flow, sediment, nutrients, and also within each of these, for each plant type and land use within each of the sub-basins, we estimate plant biomass and crop yields. Okay, let me move on to a few examples, and these are almanac studies that Jim Canary has been working on. We have a project with the Office of Naval Research to look at sugarcane production and sustainability on Maui. They have there's one sugarcane plantation left in Hawaii. It's 35,000 hectare plantation on Maui. The Navy is interested in making biofuel for their fleet, and they're looking at starting with ethanol. Jim is looking at, it's currently a two-year rotation. We're looking at different ways to manage that, different crops, different plants, grasses, just how we manage for sugar versus how we manage for biomass, different rotations, different intercropping, all kinds of things that Jim is working with there. He's trying to get parameters so we can parameterize some of the different grasses there and have the ability to really model those. So that project we're about a year into that project right now. Okay. Jim has another bioenergy grass study going, and as you can see, he has plots across from southern Texas all the way up through the southern plains over into Illinois and Missouri, several plants, different switchgrasses, miscanthus and other grasses. This happens to be at Mount Vernon, Missouri, with his cooperator at the University of Missouri. Looking at different management of these systems, also parameterizing them, getting radiation use efficiency, NNP contents over the growing season, rooting depth, canopy height, all the plant parameters that we need to model is within our ag ecosystem models. Okay. Another study that we took on, and this is at a much larger scale, this is at the entire upper Mississippi basin, the sub-watersheds, and we use SWOT on this study, and this is a couple years old. I'm not sure what the current projections are, but corn ethanol production was projected to increase to meet the growing fuel demands. With that, obviously, the rivers are subject to increased sediment and nutrient loadings. We use SWOT in the upper Mississippi basin, and what we did, and this is the same scale as SEEP that you'll see in a minute, we actually use the 8-digit hydrologic boundaries as our sub-basins. Okay, so we're looking at, you know, 1,500 square mile sub-basin that we use for our national assessment. Within those sub-basins, we model different land uses, compute the delivery to those sub-basin outlets, and then route our way down through the watershed. So the results that you're going to see are down just at the confluence of the, just at St. Louis, where you can see the confluence of the Missouri comes in right here. So we're looking at what's being delivered from the entire upper Mississippi up to this point, right before the confluence with the Missouri. So we ran scenarios looking at different, we assumed increases in crop yields over time. We ran from 2010 to 2022, looked at corn acreages, projected increase, and then actually in 2015 start to taper off a little bit, and computed the amount of ethanol, billions of liters of ethanol that would be produced from that corn yield and corn area. And then again, we looked at the amount of total nitrogen leaving in the Mississippi at this point. We looked at unit loads and kilograms per hectares, and then millions of kilograms as it left the Mississippi here. You can see we went up as the acreages increased to over 900 million kilograms, and then tapered off as we cut back on acreages. So, and this is a total outflow in the river in millions of kilograms. Okay. Let me talk about the SEEP project, and particularly Mark talked about the wetlands. There are several components of SEEP. I'll be talking about the cropland component. There is a rangeland, a wetland, and a wildlife component of SEEP in addition to the cropland component. But we've been working on the cropland component for many years now. One of the reasons we were pushed into SEEP, because after the 2002 Farm Bill, the amount of money spent on conservation funding was approached about $4 billion in payments to farmers for these conservation practices. So at that point, OMB and Congress, you know, likes to know what they're getting for what the environmental impact is for $4 billion worth of money spent. And also in addition to that, to look at the assessment to guide the design and implementation of conservation programs. Looking at more effective conservation, better management of agricultural landscapes, improving the efficacy, instead of just paying farmers first come, first serve, actually putting the targeting and putting the conservation practices in places where it has the potential to benefit the environment. Again, the first basin we ran, we're running all the 18 major river basins. The first one we ran was the upper Mississippi. Again, you can see the 8-digit boundaries. Those are our sub-watersheds. And you can also see the 4 digits, the 0701, 0702. Those are the 4-digit USGS hydrologic boundaries. And that's what we're reporting out in even though we have output it for each 8-digit, NRCS felt more comfortable reporting out at the 4-digit level for some of the national reporting. Some of the key findings, in addition to this, there was a major effort to survey the farmers. So we spent the first few years, spent several million dollars actually surveying the farmers specifically, and collected, I think, 40,000 survey points across the country, a subset of NRI, where we have very specific cropping systems, nutrient applications, pesticide applications, and structural practice data for the entire country. And what we found was that about 45% of the cropland, total cropland out for Mississippi, and 72% of the highly erodible land had structural practices in place. 95% of the cropland had reduced tillage, and 71% is either a no-till or mulch-till. With some of the model output found that edge of field compared to no practice versus the current conditions, there's an edge of field reduction of sediment about 69%, phosphorus 45, and nitrogen 18. Within stream, after we routed that through with the SWOT model, actually in the Mississippi, the in-stream reduction was about 37%. Okay, and this basically shows that. You can see the red line is no practice, just up and down slope farming, no attempt to, just basically taking the conservation practices off the field. The green is our current conditions, our current set of conservation practices, and the brown is really putting it back into grassland, so we have little contribution from the cultivated cropland. The larger, you can see the ones that are highlighted, those are the ones that are actually on the Mississippi Basin. The others are the tributaries coming in. So you can see it really bounds the simulation, the no practice versus back to grassland. Okay, some of the interesting findings, surface nitrogen loss is reduced by 46%, but subsurface losses were only reduced by 5%. So most of the conservation practices put on the land were for surface runoff and erosion type control. So there was very little control. And in some cases, with the practices in place, we actually increased the amount of nitrogen because we increased the subsurface and some of the tile flow components. So it's very important to always look at all the sources and the impact of conservation on that. Then after that, we looked at treating, targeting areas. So we had 36 million acres that were targeted as undertreated for sediment or nutrient loss. If we treated those acres, we would cut nitrogen loss in the subsurface flow by 48%, and you can see the nitrogen, total nitrogen and total phosphorus reduction around 50%. And we also targeted areas, 8.5 million acres that we targeted as critically undertreated, and those would have a significant 20 to 40% cut in sediment, nitrogen, and phosphorus. So we feel like we can target areas. And now this is what we just talked about. The green, again, is current conditions, and the other bars are treating some of these, not just treating the whole area, but targeting these critically undertreated areas. Okay, so we've talked about some of the ways the models are needed and used, and these models are being used around the world routinely. I think there are 800 papers now in the refereed literature on SWOT application development validation around the world, and probably a similar number of EPIC, APEX, and others. So they're being used to look at the impact of land management and climate, and landscape and watershed scales, and multiple responses and process interactions. And one of the things that we're working with the Nature Conservancy to try to link the SWOT output to fish habitat and fish health, aquatic health. So I think what we need to, one of the things we really need to do now is take the output from the models and link them directly with some of the ecology models, the stream health, habitat type models, as we move forward. Thank you.
Thanks, Jeff. Questions, Jeff?
Sure.
How readily
Yeah, as far as the riverbank erosion, we do have a riverbank model based on stream power that we compute, and the channel can agrade, depending on the flow characteristics, the channel can agrade or deposit. It gets out over bank in the floodplain, then we typically deposit. Now, as far as picking up nutrients with that sediment, We really have a very simple model right now. We just have the concentration of the NNP. We input a concentration of NNP in that bank sediment, and if we do pick it up, then we transport it. But that's something that really needs to be looked at in the model, and something I think we could improve fairly easily.